It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Want to welcome everybody to this evening's Mauer Report. First and foremost, I was just telling Matthew I had some surgery last week, and or was that? No, it was 2 weeks ago because it was on a Wednesday. So I'm 2 weeks out tomorrow, and last week I went nuts because I literally couldn't have done the show if I wanted to because I was barely talking, let alone announcing words, and it was bad. And so thanks all for the all well wishes. Doing a lot better. We'll see if my voice actually holds up for the show, but I'm sure Matthew will cover for me if I start to slow down here. My guest tonight is Matthew. Oh, D. You just said this, and I just psyched myself totally out on it.
DBOZ.
Jeez, a pizza. I even wrote it down kind of phonetically, and then, yeah. And you're the author of Lord of the Gridiron, College Football Greatest Coaches. How many are in the book? I'm not gonna ask you to spill the beans, but how many coaches are in the book?
Well, I featured the top 50, and I isolated the top 50 out of a pool of 416 coaches who coached in Division 1A college football, strictly 1A.
Okay, so that'd be like that's the big schools, right, for the people who aren't well-versed in college athletics.
That's right. I'm not talking about Division 2 or Division 3 or Division 1AA. You know, you won't see coaches like Jake Gaithers or Eddie Robinson. You know, just strictly the Division 1A coaches. You know, the SEC, the Big Ten. You know, the Power Five conferences and those other conferences that comprise Division 1A college football.
So Division 1A goes back to, I want to say, around the turn of the last century, the 19th century. Am I correct in that?
Actually, the concept of divisions, I think Division II and Division III were constituted in 72, 73, thereabouts.
Oh.
But, yeah, I mean, they didn't really have Division II and Division III in the early years. But we're strictly talking about what we now know today as Division 1A. And what I did was I devised a rating system, a plus-minus rating system where, based on winning your seasonal winning percentage, where like if you go 7-6, you would only get 1 point. Whereas if you had a perfect season, you would get 14 points. And there would also be little bonuses, like if you made a minor bowl game appearance, you would get 9 points. If you made a major bowl game appearance, you would get 11 points. If you won a major bowl game, you would get 12 points. If you won the national championship, you would win 15 points. So on a scale of, it was a plus scale of 1 to 15. Conversely, the minus system, if you went 6-7 in a season, you would lose 1 point off your career value. Or if you went, if you lost a minor bowl game, you would lose 10 points. If you lost a major bowl game, you would lose 12 points. Like Bo Schembechler, he lost 10 major bowl games. That's a lot of points he lost off his value there. So that's why he ranks somewhere in the mid 40s, you know, according to my rating system, because of all those major bowl game losses. So it's important, you know. It's important that if you're like Urban Meyer, your teams are always at a high octane, consistent high octane level, and they're winning their bowl games, either major or minor bowl games. You know, you can do very good for yourself. That's why Urban Meyer ranks among the top five in my book. I had the great honor and privilege of interviewing him. He was actually my last interview. It was last January. I think it was 3 weeks after he had coached his last game, you know, the 2019 Rose Bowl. We got to talk. You know, he was retired. He was free and clear. And he gave me a very wonderful interview about his career and his accomplishments and also some great insights about his coaching contemporaries like Nick Saban, Gary Patterson, Chris Peterson, Dabo Sweeney. Great interview there.
So I guess since you were at Urban Meyer, I told you this isn't a sports show, but this is kind of something that I follow or have a passion for. Do you believe he's done?
No. I'm kind of surprised that he didn't pick up another coaching gig this year. But when I talked to him, we kind of asked, are you absolutely done? He refused to absolutely close the door. However, his health issues, his arachnoid cyst and other issues have, you know, it ended his career in Florida and it ended his career here in Ohio State, among other things. But it was, they are real issues. So apparently, you know, he desperately needed the rest. And I'm not closing I would refuse to close the door. Urban Meyer is roughly my age. He may be a few months younger than I am, you know, and I'm 56 years old. And as I stated in my book, he is simply much too great a coach to hang it all up. He still has a lot to contribute to the game. If he can just regain his health, you know, get rid of his pains, you know, his arachnoid cyst pains, and be able to, you know, relax again. You know, he's still the greatest unhired coach in the game today. And I figure sooner or later, if the right situation happens, he'll get another gig again. I'm pretty positive of it. I mean, I think it would have to take something, either a health issue that we just don't know about, he's not telling us, or else maybe he's holding out for a pro job. I don't know. I mean, there was rumors a month ago about him taking the USC job, and I thought that would have been perfect for him because, hey, USC desperately needs someone of his caliber to revive that program because they've never been the same since Pete Carroll left. But apparently it didn't happen, and who knows what, you know, what's he doing. I mean, right now he's working for ESPN, but we just have to see what, you know, what comes in over the transom. Certainly not this year, but probably maybe this time next year something might happen. Well, we just have to see, Jim.
Well, that's the fun part of this, right? There's always that one name out there.
Yeah, I mean, he's still the greatest name. According to my rating system, I'm right now with the retirement of Chris Peterson, even Peterson. He probably will take a brief sabbatical, but again, he's much too great a coach to be, you know, hanging fire. I mean, sooner or later, I think he's going to find another gig. You know, it's going to take some time, but I can understand. I mean, his years at Washington were not really the same as what he was doing at Boise State. And this past season, it was very much hit and miss. I mean, he managed to pull out that bowl game victory, but it was a very subpar season. I think he's probably exhausted all of his possibilities at Washington. I think he just needs to pull back, reassess, and then wait for the next opportunity that comes in. It'll be interesting to see which one it'll be. I mean, he's a native Californian. I'm a West Coast guy. I wonder, will it be another Pac-12 job or maybe go someplace else? It'll be very interesting to see what happens.
I'm fascinated by this name to no end. And he's not in your top 50 coaches. Not yet. Probably could end up there.
Who's that?
Lane Kiffin. Lane Kiffin.
Yeah. I forget if I have him. I forget if I have him on my list. If he's on the thing or not. I don't see him right here right now.
I don't think he has enough college win because he was in the NFL for a while.
Right. That's another thing. To be eligible for my book, you had to have a minimum of 10 seasons at Division 1A level to be eligible. If he has not done 10, I don't think he's done 10. That's the reason why he's not in my book. Okay.
I was going to say, I don't think he's done 10 at the Division I level, at least.
And that explains why he's not in the book. He has not yet done his 10 and all that. There are only two coaches who I didn't meet the 10-year thing. That's Pete Carroll and Walter Camp, the man who virtually invented American college football. And Pete Carroll, the exceptions I made were, I explained in the book, they had a career winning percentage of over 750, and they won two national championships in less than those 10 years. So that's the reason why I made those exceptions, because both men, you know, they won two national championships and they were just absolutely exceptional records. They're the only exceptions to my 10-year rule.
So I've got a two-part question, because the second part's way too loaded. How about games that the NCAA came back through and said you didn't technically win them? Through sanctions,
you mean because they violated the rules and all that? No. I refuse to take that into account. What you did originally is what I went by. In other words, if you, like Pete Carroll, you know, he had his wins and validated because of the Reggie Bush scandal and all that. I totally ignored that. I went with what actually happened originally at that given moment of time. So there is no taking into consideration, like the Joe Paterno scandal, you know, where certain things he did were invalidated and all that. No, I refuse to take that into consideration. I always went by what happened originally at that given moment in time.
That was the loaded part of the question, because I know you're from the other side of the state. I'm from the Pittsburgh side of Pennsylvania. So what we meet in the middle at State College here, and what a tragic end to all of that.
Yeah, I know. Now people are kind of surprised that I had Joe Paterno not even ranked among the top five, and I'll explain this way. The problem with Joe Pa is that if you looked at his record during the 21st century in the 2000s up to the end, his performance in the 21st century was not exactly good, and that really cost him in one of my four rating categories, the average season rating, which measures the quality of a coach's performance. He had some very poor and some mediocre seasons, and that really brought him down, and that's why his ASR rating is not as high as his career value or his B5 value, which was his best five seasons overall. That kind of harmed him, that he lost several steps in rank. Now, in the other category, the BQ value, which it's a Latin term for quinquennium, which stands for five years. It measures your best five straight years, five consecutive years. It measures a coach's ability to maintain consistent high-octane performance. Paterno's five consecutive years, I had to use the period from 68 to 72, and people would wonder, how come I didn't use the 82 to 86 period, because he won two national championships in that time period, is because after the 82 national championship, he had a losing season, a really bad subpar year, and then he lost out in 85 to Barry Switzer, and that actually cost him. So that was not exactly his best five straight years according to my rating system. I had to use the 68 to 72 period. And the problem is, even though he had two consecutive perfect seasons in 68-69, he didn't win a national championship. And the obvious reason was that the strength of schedule. It didn't measure up to Ohio State's schedule in 68 when they won the national championship, or Texas's schedule in 69 when they won the national championship, because they played much stronger opposition. So that's another reason why Joe Paterno failed to rank among the top five according to my rating system there. But I was able to interview two players, one of which whose material I used, like Bob Cech. He was a center for Penn State in the early 90s, and he's there now. He's a school principal, and he gave me incredible insights, which you see in the book there, about what it was, you know. It wasn't just, you know, making great football players. He developed human beings. In other words, what were you going to do after the cheering stopped and you hung up the football uniform for the last time? What are you going to do with your life? And he wanted his players to make something substantial of themselves. Be substantial, okay? Don't be a walking monument to the game, but be a contributor to the community. And that's why Bob Cech now has long been a school administrator, a school principal, someplace in central PA. And he's done that for quite a long time. And he really got into, you know, Paterno's intellectual side. This was a man who understood history. He was schooled in the classics. He could recite the Roman poet Virgil. He loved the Aeneid. He could discuss political history, military history. I mean, he was so learned and educated. I mean, Bob Cech said he wasn't one for giving Rockne-type speeches, but like the night before the games, he would have a talk with the team, and he said the scholarly nature, the erudition, I mean, he said that it was like the president walking in the room. He had such command presence because of his intellectual powers. And, you know, and he created this magnificent legacy, and then the Sandusky scandal happened, and all of a sudden now all that monument, all those beautiful living monuments he created because of, you know, what he did at Penn State, are all washed away because of the blackness of this scandal. I mean, the horrific nature of it all. It's eerie, you know, the utmost high, and then come totally besmirched, tarnished, you know, forever. I mean, just. And such a way, too, you know, just, and it's mind-boggling to contemplate. And the possibility that if he had not died when he did, he probably, like the others, you know, Spanier and the others, probably would have gone to jail because of that scandal. That's the mind-boggling aspect of it, Jim.
Yeah, it truly is. And then, was it 2 years ago?
Yeah.
Or was it last summer? Anyways, at one point we were driving across the state, and we were looking for lunch. I said, oh, we'll stop at State College and, you know, have some lunch, do some shopping, get out of the car, stretch your legs a little bit. So I drove up by the stadium, by where the statue was. Now, I've been there. There's somewhere on one of these external hard drives I have floating around. There's a picture of me and Joe Paterno's statue.
Yeah.
So I went up there, and to go up there, and it's not there, and it's weird.
I know. I mean, decades of magnificent accomplishment. I remember when he spoke at the Republican convention. I think was it 88 or is it 88 or 92? I remember that because, you know, he was a lifelong Republican, and he gave a speech, you know, endorsing, you know, George Herbert Walker Bush, you know, H.W. Bush and all of that. I mean, he was courted by presidents. Joe DiMaggio respected and admired him enormously. You know, I mean, just, and then all this was happening. I remember I talked about the, I would talk to some coaches, I won't name names, I mean, asking him, not on the record, but off the record, you know, about what his thoughts about it. And it just, they were all shocked and stunned. It's like, they just couldn't believe it. It's like, Joe? You know, it's like, it was like a nationwide gobsmack in the college football world for something like that to happen. It was just a gobsmack.
And the other thing that the factors of interest me is the length of time there, because we were talking about Urban a few minutes ago. I mean, he's bounced around from Utah to Florida to Ohio State. I mean, Joe was there. I mean, for years.
Generations. So, in fact, even before he became head coach, he got there. Was it 50 or 51? He was like, he did like a 16-year apprenticeship as an assistant coach. So, I mean, literally for 6 decades, you know, at one place. I mean, he literally put State College on the college football map, because before he came, I mean, Penn State University was just, it was just little something in the backwoods, man. No one paid it any mind. And he made it a power. He got them into the Big Ten. I mean, it was amazing. I think it was a mistake he got them in the Big Ten. I wish he had gone into ACC, because if he had done that, he might have had gotten some more shots at national championships, because when he went into the Big Ten in the early years of the college football thing, the Bowl Coalition, Bowl Alliance, and the BCS, Big Ten was not really part of that, and that's why they missed out on some opportunities. Like 1994, they should have played Nebraska for the national championship due to their perfect record, but they were contractually locked into the Rose Bowl, and that's why, you know, Nebraska played, Florida State, you know, Miami or Florida, I think it was Miami, you know, for the national championship there, and it cost them, you know. And I always thought that was a little bit of a mistake. He probably should have gone ACC like Bobby Bowden did with Florida State. He probably would have had more chances, you know, to get a shot at the national championship, in my view.
So you mentioned your formulas. Was there any room in there for the eyeball test or the you mentioned Newt Rockne. There's certain names that just carry some more weight.
No, not just this book here, but my previous books. What I always strive to do is avoid subjectivity. What I always try to do is create a system based on hard, verifiable numbers, where I'm trying to eliminate potential sectional biases, geographical biases, anything that has a tinge of subjectivity to it. I'm trying to get on something that's hard and verifiable based on winning percentage, which, you know, you can't argue with that the record is there. Like I talk about this in the book. For in the early years when I was working on this, I contemplated like awarding points, like if you finished among the top five, you would get X amount of points. If you were in the top 10, you would get Y amount of points. But then in the end, I decided to do it, but I didn't do it because when you look at the polling, there are some years where there are disputes. I mean, is it really an accurate poll? And I thought, yeah, if I went by poll finishes, then that's kind of introducing like subjectivity there. Another thing about Penn State is this is something that always drove me crazy when I was rooting for them. Penn State would start a certain year during their glory years very high up, if not number one, like number two. But the moment they would lose a game, the pollsters would always drop them from like one or two all the way down to 25, whereas if it was like Alabama and they lost their first game and they were high up, they would go from like one or two to only like 10 or nine, which means they would lead still, you know, early in the season, they would still have a shot at regaining a chance to win the national championship, whereas Penn State, the moment they lost the game, boom, you're off the scale. And yeah, by the time they would finish, they would be like 10 or 9, and, you know, no, and on the outside knocking in. I always felt there was a little bit of a prejudice there, and that's, you know, that's the feeling. Did you ever get that feeling, Jim, you know?
Actually,
I did.
Did
you ever get that impression? Yeah. I always thought there was that. I always noticed that year after year that would happen, you know. And even when the Sandusky scandal exploded and the draconian punishments that the NCAA inflicted on Penn State University, I had this weird feeling if this had happened like at Alabama or like Florida State or Florida, would, or Texas or Oklahoma, would the punishments have been that severe and that draconian? I mean, that's the rhetorical question I put out to you, Jim, and to your listeners. I mean, what do you think, Jim? I mean, do you feel the same way, or no, that's a bit of a stretch? How do you feel, Jim?
It's a good question. I think, well, being biased, it seemed to me because, you know, the time there. I mean, if it would have been a coach that had been at the school for 10 years and had all the extra history, the library named after him and all this other stuff, I don't know if it would have seemed as crushing to that university as it did to Penn State in particular.
Yeah. I don't know. It's just sometimes I wonder, because there was like I know after the Sandusky scandal exploded, there was a lot of rush among certain people, you know, to try to add more tarnish to Joe Paterno's halo. You know, there was a certain aspect to it. I mean, among certain observers there.
So you've mentioned doing a couple. How many interviews did you end up doing for the book?
I interviewed Tom Osborne, Urban Meyer, Mac Brown, who's going to be in a few days competing in a bowl game, trying to salvage a winning season at University of North Carolina. I talked to him like several months before he took the UNC job. I talked to Bob Stoops, Lou Holtz. Lou Holtz was fantastic with me. I talked to Jim Tressel. I talked to Steve Spurrier, talked to him. Who else? Jim Tressel, yeah. And not just coaches. I also talked to, you know, former players, some Heisman Trophy winners like Johnny Rogers, who in Nebraska, General Pete Dawkins, who won the 1958 Heisman Trophy. Talked to him. Talked to three guys who played for Bobby Dodd at Georgia Tech in the 1950s. Talked to three Oklahoma Sooners who played for Bud Wilkinson at Oklahoma in the 1950s. Even talked to an old Notre Dame player who played for Frank Leahy in 1948, who later went into the CIA, you know. He was a great guy. Yeah, seriously. Talked about, you know, hey, from 46 to 49, Notre Dame was unbeaten. They won three national championships in a four-year time span. I mean, that was one of the most glorious performances in Notre Dame history, Frank Leahy. And it was featured in my book there. I had like over 34 hours of interviews. I talked to Jim McMahon, you know, the Chicago Bears fame. We talked about Lavelle Edwards at Brigham Young. In fact, they're playing tonight, you know, the Hawaii Bowl, you know.
That's part of the reason I wanted to get you on. That's part of the reason I wanted to get you on right now, because when I go to turn this, it'll be right around New Year's Day. And what more popular thing than there is to college football. So,
yeah.
So, two easy questions for you, and then we'll turn gears here a little bit. One person that you'd like to talk to that you didn't get the opportunity to talk to.
I couldn't talk to?
Yeah.
Oh, I wish I could have talked to Saban. But, you know, Saban, I tried to reach out to him several, two, 3 years ago, but it's not just me. I mean, he's very controlled about whom he talks to. You know, he's not that accessible, and even then, and not particularly revealing and all of that. Who I could have talked to? I would love to have talked to Barry Switzer. I was able to contact his wife, but he was on the road, and we couldn't really get it together. But oh, what a character he was. I mean, why they never made a movie on his life? I mean, they've taken his book Bootleggers, boy, and convert that into a movie is beyond me, because his is the stuff of a Hollywood movie. Just what a character. I mean, a magnificent coach, but, man, that situation in Oklahoma. I mean, I talk about in the book, if you take a look at all the basically the lurking scandals, the sex, the lies, the videotape, the rock and roll, the characters there, Bosworth and all that, it would have made for a great long-running cable TV miniseries. Seriously. It was wild.
And then you backed up. Then you backed it up with the Cowboys.
Yeah. I mean, Jimmy Johnson and Pete Carroll, the only men ever win a college football national championship and the Super Bowl, a very small club.
If my voice was feeling better, I would have given you the Jimmy Johnson, how about those Cowboys, but I don't think I have it tonight.
Probably blew
out your ear, too. Oh, okay. Most serious question, though. Where can people find the book and find you before we get off into a tangent about something else?
You must buy it online at Amazon. It's not available in stores. I self-published this through Kindle Digital Publishing, which is Amazon's digital subsidiary there. I self-published it. I probably could have gotten a conventional publishing deal for this, but unfortunately, the conventional publishing companies really wanted me to cut the manuscript severely, because it's a 350-page manuscript. They wanted to chop it down to 280. And there was no way I could have done that without raping and gutting the central intellectual thrust of the book there. I would have had to leave almost most of that beautiful interview material that I got, which really is, to me, the real meat and heart and soul of that book, the players and the coaches discussing how it went down, you know, what was the secret to these coaches' greatness. I would have reduced my book to a Dick and Jane reader, and this is not a Dick and Jane reader, and I owed it to those men who cooperated with me that their memories and their insights are kept in this book here. So that's the reason why I self-publish it. So to buy it, you must go on Amazon, just look up my name, Matthew DiBiase, or type in the title Lords of the Gridiron, College Football's Greatest Coaches, and there you will have it. And right now it's on sale due to Christmas season, and it will remain on sale at 30% off until after the national championship game is played. Then it'll go back to full price. So you want to get a bargain? Buy it right now, sports fans.
That's right. Okay, so I told you we're going to shift gears a little bit now. I was reading your Amazon bio, and I stumbled. There's some great nuggets in there. But, as I'm sitting here ranking priorities, as I look towards the other, like I told you, there's a lot of good stuff that you do, and I want to get to. I seen that you were on Jeopardy.
Yes.
Some more powerful words that I need. I need Alex Trebek right now.
Guess what? It was 28 years ago. It was the first week of December, 1991. I flew out to California. First time in my life I ever flew out to California. And, I taped an episode. They film five episodes. 2 days they devote to filming episodes. They do five episodes a day for 2 days. And I was the fourth of that day, and I competed, and I lost by a buck. I ended up with $14,400, and the other guy beat me by a dollar. He was lucky. He wasn't smarter than me. And the air date of my show was March 12, 1992. And I got he actually talked to me the most. Of the three contestants, he actually talked to me the most. What I remember at the time was, this was 27 years ago, his hair was salt and peppery, and he was a little bit shorter than I am. What I remember was his chin. It was like someone had taken a chisel and chiseled it in a perfectly straight line. I mean, I remember how perfectly defined his chin was, you know, and all that. But he was quite nice. He was about as friendly as a celeb could be, and he talked to me the most. And I remember, I told him, I remember watching you as a kid when you were the MC of High Rollers, and he said, please don't remind me. that was my first 22 minutes of fame. And, it's a pity. I mean, I wish I had that $14,000 right now.
So I guess the question...
The
question becomes, were you planning on going there to try to be on Jeopardy, or were you just one of those blind last minute kind of deals?
Oh, Oh, I had been devotedly watching Jeopardy from like since 1981, and I kept thinking, you know, I'm good enough to do this. So they always have contestant things, like they at Merv Griffin's Resort Casino, and so sometime in 1991 they had a thing there. They would always put it on your local TV channel. If you want to become a contestant, Merv Griffin's Resort Casino in Atlantic City is having a thing. You take the test and all that. So I took the first test, passed it, and then you have to take a second, more complicated test. And I passed that, and then came the audition. The audition was right after the second test, and I passed that audition, and that was like the summer of 91. And, okay, you passed the test, and they said, okay, be alert. Sometime between, was it like August and whatever, you're going to get a call from us, and you have to, you know, you have to fly out to California and on this date to, you know, to do your thing. So just be alert. It could come at any time. And then sometime was like, it was like late October, early November, I got the call. You know, hey, we want you to fly out. And I did it. And I flew out to California that first week of December. Sadly, I lost my game. And, and I just, you know, hung around and met some friends and relatives there. And then I flew home. I always had a shot at a second game show. Was it 17 years ago? There was this thing on the History Channel called History Now. They filmed that in New York City. I think me and my father were the only people who ever watched it because it only lasted that one season. And I was killer. I was killer on that show. And I actually did it. And the thing was, they wanted to have me on, but the thing is, the dates they gave me, I had to be on the road someplace. I couldn't make it, so I told them, okay, I'll wait for your next season. We'll try again. There was never another season. I wish I'd been on. I would have killed them. I would have annihilated all competition that day. I was a killer on that show. I was awesome playing along with it. Seriously. Yeah.
What's the name? It's probably right here in the top of my mind. I can't figure it, but there's a documentary on, I want to say Netflix, about the guy who got the prices right and got like the prices right on the prices right.
I don't know about that. No,
but it's remarkable because he created a computer program so he could like memorize these things. I mean, he was like into it. Oh.
Yeah. Oh, I'm not like that, man. I'm not like one of those card counters who could multiply 100 billion by 2 million, 2.5666 million or something. No, I can't do it like that, man. No. I'm not like that.
I was gonna say if you could count cards at 14,000, wouldn't seem nearly as significant as much.
Yeah. You know, what I mean, like Rain Man. That, you know, he could do that card counting like that. He had that idiot savant thing. No, I'm not like that. Not like that. No.
Yeah. You've been writing for a while though, like you've
books. My first book came out in 2015, but actually I've been writing since the age of 17. I started off writing song lyrics, poetry and song lyrics, and not really prose, mostly just song lyrics and poetry, and I kept doing that through college, and then when I went into grad school, I became an op-ed columnist for my student newspaper. I was doing like my college kids imitation of like David Broder or Walter Lippmann or, you know, someone like that, you know, George Will or something like that, a poor man's bit of George, you know, stuff like that from a liberal standpoint, you know, not to be political or anything like that, but that's what it was. And I did that. I was enjoying myself immensely. I wasn't just talking politics. I'd write about anything. And I was doing that on a weekly basis when I was in semester, you know, fall and spring semesters from like 87, 89. And actually, I discovered I was pretty good at writing prose. And I was getting like people saying, hey, that was a great article. I was getting real good feedback and stuff like that. And from time to time, I would contribute think pieces to like a local area newspapers like the Camden Courier Post and the Burlington County Times. I even tried it with the Philadelphia Inquirer, but they never printed my stuff. And then I kind of put that aside for a time, and I went back to like writing song lyrics and all that and poetry. And then In the mid-2000s, I started this book project, which never really got off the ground. I wanted to do an oral history of the NHL's original six era, which there only had six teams from 1942 to 1967. And I was going around North America, you know, U.S. and the Canada, talking to old hockey players, including some living legends like Henri Richard and Red Kelly and, you know, Glenn Hall, guys like that, talking to them about their careers, Emil Francis. But the book, at the end, I had to shelve it. I just thought, I can't really make this a reality. And then I started contributing stuff for, like, Inside Hockey, which is an online hockey magazine. I used to write more often, but now I don't write as much. And I did this series about the 50 greatest NHL coaches. I developed this crude little system. And it just built up, and someone, again, I was getting very positive feedback, and someone said, Matt, you ought to make a book out of this. So I started working on it, and it took me like 2 years, and I was still refining my method. And then finally in 2013, I actually got a conventional publishing contract, Penguin Random House Canada, and my first book, Bench Bosses, came out, which, you know, the NHL's coaching elite, which reveals the 50 greatest NHL head coaches of all time, as determined by a system I created. And then I tried to do something for basketball, but I couldn't get a publishing contract. So I shelved that, and I went instead, I broke new ground with my second book, which is The Art of the Dealers, the NHL's Greatest General Managers, which was another groundbreaking work. It's the first time in the history of sports literature dealing with the four top North American sports, baseball, football, hockey, and basketball, someone wrote a book identifying the greatest general managers of a sport using a metrical system. It's never been done before. It's literally the first and only of its kind. And that came out in 2017. And right as soon as I got that done, I went right into my present book, the college football book, and I worked that nonstop, round the clock, for two and a half years. And the end result is Lords of the Gridiron, College Football's Greatest Coaches. And right now I'm working on my fourth book, which will be called Lords of the Gridiron Part 2, Pro Football's Greatest Coaches. And I've been working on that since September, and the release date for that will be September 1st, 2022. And I've been interviewing pro football players, you know, coaches and pro football players like Marv Levy, Dan Reeves. I was talking to, like, Gary Quazzo, an old Minnesota Vikings quarterback. He played for the Colts. And, you know, Bud Grant at Minnesota and Don Shula, been talking to them about their memories. I've talked to, like, Leroy Jordan about Tom Landry, Jim McMahon about Mike Ditka, you know, guys like that. And I'm putting that together. And I devised a rating system. It's a six-tiered rating system where I will identify the 50 greatest NFL head coaches of all time. And you'll 3 years from now, Jim, we'll be talking about this book, okay?
Yes, sir. As long as I'm still here and you're still here, we'll do it. I'm game. That's a bad pun.
So
back to the NHL book for a minute. I have an idea. Yep. I mean, total shot in the dark here. But I'm betting Scotty Bowman's in the top five.
Oh, he's numero uno. I mean, actually, his record, he just annihilated all the competition. I knew he was going to be number one. The question was, who was going to occupy slots 2 to 50? That was the real question, you know, in the book. And, I mean, just Bowman just totally annihilated all competition. I mean, other coaches. I talked to Ken Hitchcock. I talked to, Emil Francis and just guys like that. And it was just an amazing experience, you know, and it kind of opened up worlds for me, you know, knowing that I could get this done and that, you know, it's up there on Amazon. All three of my books are up on Amazon. Only the first book you could buy at a bookstore, though I right now it's like a rock bottom remainder and all of that. But yeah, all three of my books are available on Amazon if you want to buy them. And people are buying my general manager's book. I mean, even though it's one of the most arcane and obscure topics you can imagine, people are still buying it, which is quite a thrill for me. It's kind of like an affirmation of my research. But, I mean, imagine if someone had done a book about the 50 greatest baseball general managers. I mean, imagine comparing, like, who was really greater? Was Branch Rickey greater than George Weiss of the Yankees? I mean, who is the greatest general manager in baseball history? Wouldn't it be fascinating if someone actually made the attempt and found out? You know, who knows? You know, if using a system, a metrical system, it would be interesting to find out. You know,
coming 2023, and then it's followed by the penultimate book here. The ultimate book, I guess, would be you get the four major sports, you know, coaches, number one versus number one versus number one. Who is the coach?
Yeah, I mean, just we're trying to work that out, you know, and that's what I'm trying to work out with my pro football book. And I think it's going to surprise some people when it comes out. It kind of surprised me where certain coaches rate and rank and all of that. I think it'll surprise. It's going to be like certain coaches you would think are going to be like top 10 or top 5 material, and actually, no, they're not. And I've got a lot of explaining to do, and I'm doing the explaining right here and now as I'm writing this book, you know. I'm up to chapter 14 right now, and next Sunday I'll work on chapter 15 and all that. You know, I do like, you know, chapter a week and all that. And it's going to be very surprising. You know, certain coaches you think are high echelon, and no, not what you think. And there will be explanations for that when my book comes out 3 years from now. Believe me. Yeah, you'll probably be just as surprised as the other readers, and you and I are probably going to be, you're going to be asking me, okay, why? You know, why is such and such not in the top 10? And I'm going to have to explain that to you, Jim, okay?
But when you follow the statistics, like, you know, if you sat there and picked, I don't want to say picked names out of a hat, that's a little bit ridiculous, but if you would have went more subjectively, right, based off your opinion, I guess, more so than pulling them out of a hat, that's when the discussion can happen, right? But if you're hardline numbers, I mean, it's hard to argue numbers. Numbers never lie.
Right, right. And that's the thing. You've got to. That's what I'm always trying to do, Jim. I'm trying to remove potential biases. You know, like I'm an Eagles fan. You know, of course we're supposed to hate the Dallas Cowboys, but you can't think of those terms. You can't have anti-Dallas bias. You have to go by the hard, verifiable numbers. What did these coaches actually do? And you just can't pick out, okay, I'm just going to ignore I'm going to just choose the great years, and I'm going to ignore the poor years. No, you must see their career in its totality. You have to take the rough with the smooth. You have to figure out that, yeah, you know, like Tom Landry, in his first 7 years of coaching, was actually had a very lousy record. Very.
Uh-oh.
Now with 7-7, no playoff appearances. I mean, he had a he went into a hole very quickly, and took him some time to get out of it. Look at Bill Belichick, his years at Cleveland. Not world beating, man. Not the greatest in the world. You know, even his first season with New England was not the greatest in the world. But then finally, he hit the magic formula. Now he's way up there, man. You know, he's way up there, Jim, and he's not finished yet. You know.
Okay, so Jimmy Johnson's the best Cowboys coach, right? Not to give anything away, Landry was there longer, like you were saying, doesn't have all the. Because Jimmy was there for
a
short burst.
I mean, according to my race, no, Jimmy John's not the greatest Cowboys coach. I mean, it's still Tom. You know, it's still Tom Landry. You know, I'm not going to tell you where.
Here we are. I mean, I just randomly pulled one because there's, you know, two classic examples of coaches that are both on your list.
Actually, despite the fact that he won back-to-back Super Bowls, Jimmy Johnson's pro record. They focused on the years in Dallas, but what about those years in Miami? And actually, in Miami with the Dolphins were not exactly world-beating years. I mean, he had winning seasons, but they were not as good as his Dallas years. So people might be surprised where I rank Jimmy Johnson when my book comes out 3 years from now. And like I said, Jim, we're going to talk about that, okay, 3 years from now, okay?
I totally forgot the Miami crap.
That's right. That's right. You see, that's why. When I look at a career, you have to look at the totality of it, everything. You just can't ignore, you just can't pick the great years and ignore the bad ones. You've got to see it absolutely overall, every aspect of it, and you can't ignore it. You know, it has to be seen completely.
Can we put Jimmy's hurricane stuff in there? Maybe.
Guess what? Jimmy Johnson's not in my top 50 in my college football book. He didn't make it. In fact, I talk about it in my methodology chapter. I use them as an example. Okay, for each of my four rating categories, Jimmy Johnson's career value was 0.27. His ASR thing is X. his BQ value is Y, his B5 value is Z. And he, and when I did the final evaluation, I think it was, he was ranked in the 60s, somewhere in the 60s. And I explained why. One, he coached at Oklahoma. His first coaching gig was not a University of Miami, it was Oklahoma State, and he had like two losing seasons there. That was one aspect of it. Secondly, those two national championships they lost out on when Penn State beat him in the 87 Fiesta Bowl, that cost him points. And also, when he lost the Catholics versus Convicts game against Notre Dame, remember, Miami was number one, knocked him off the number one spot, and it cost him a national championship. And I said, if he had won those two national championships, guess what? Then he would have cracked the top 50 ranks, and he would have been featured in my book. But it didn't happen. So there you go.
Yeah, I'm sitting now. I've brought up the, you know, the bio on him, and I'm sitting here looking at it going, man, that's not what I wanted to see.
Yeah, but that's the way it is, man. You know, missed opportunities, man. You know, just and again, I had to look at the totality of his career, and that's what it came up. You know, that's the way it is. There's a lot of famous names who didn't make the top 50, like Amos Alonzo Stagg, Frank Broyles, John Heisman, for whom the Heisman Trophy is named after. He didn't make it. There's a bunch of notable guys who did not pass muster because, you know, Duffy Daugherty at Michigan State didn't make it. Simply because John Robinson at USC didn't make it. Then because there were some lean periods that really played against him and it harmed him in the eyes of my rating system. Hayden Fry, who just died recently at Iowa, I had him ranked 128th all time. You know, even despite his great work at Iowa. I mean, he inspired Bob Stoops to become a coach in his own right there. I remember when I interviewed Bob Stoops, he talked about what an influence Hayden Fry was.
You mentioned John Heisman. He grew up not too far from where I'm at right now.
Yeah. The thing is, when he left Georgia Tech, his years after that kind of dragged him down a little bit. I mean, it was very close for that top 50 spot. He was in a dead tie with Dana X Bible for that 50th spot. But using the preponderance protocol, Bible topped Heisman in three of the four categories, and that's why Dana X Bible is ranked 50th and John Heisman is ranked 51st.
Does he get any credit for coaching baseball or basketball?
Nope. Just strictly what they did in football. Again, you know, just.
Oh, wait. Now I'm scrolling down the rest of the record here, and that basketball record's not going to help him any.
No. Yeah. Don't laugh. I will do basketball. I mean, I still want to do a pro basketball book. I want to do a college hoops book. I figure 10 years from now, I want to do something, the 50 greatest college basketball coaches of all time. I mean, I've got a plan where my next book's pro football. That's 2022. And then I want to follow it up with the 50 greatest Major League Baseball managers. I want that to come out in 2026, and then the one after that will either be my pro basketball book or my college basketball book. So I've got a lot of, as long as I'm still breathing, I'm still going to be writing my books there. So, you know, Jim, we'll be doing a lot in the decade to come. I'll be on your show again and again talking about my next releases. Okay, Jim?
Hey, I'm serious, man. I enjoy the sports. I don't, like I said, I normally don't get there. I think been doing this show for 8.5 years. I talked sports for the first time in January. I had NASCAR Truck Series driver Jesse Awuji on, so that was kind of a cool thing. Yeah, I mean, the opportunity knocked, and I said, well, a guy at that level I just can't say no to, and so I took him, and then we're talking sports tonight. So kind of, there's people out there who don't like when I talk politics, and how I'm talking sports, and, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
Balance it out a little bit.
I'm very grateful, Jim, for you having me on. I really appreciate it. I mean, actually, this, like I said before, you know, this is a great Christmas gift, and I'm most grateful, Jim, really, from the bottom of my heart. Thank you.
Well, thank you, because like I said, I was looking for something. It's a weird time of year, right? Because most of my contemporaries are off tonight, right? It's Christmas Eve, New Year's Eve next week. But I like being here because there's some people out there who really look forward to this. I know I do. And, you know, maybe aren't having the greatest time with their family. So maybe they need to get out and, you know, something out and take their mind off it. So that's why I'm here. And then this time of year, it's a weird time of year. And I don't necessarily want to be talking, you know, politics or demons, you know, any of these weird things. So what's a great kind of topic?
Yeah.
Well, sports. So it works well.
And, Yeah, besides, this is the 150th anniversary of the very first college football game, which was actually a month ago in early November when Rutgers played Princeton. So that's the reason why I put this book out. You know, it was to coincide with that 150th anniversary there. And it's just, it was just a simple little game, you know, and Rutgers won 6-4. And the game that they played bears very little resemblance to the way the game of football is played now. It was more like a kicking game, more like soccer. And yet, from that little game, you have this mega-billion-dollar industry that is coast-to-coast, broadcast around the world, you know, and you have college football programs. They have bureaucracies that are more labyrinthine than the White House when you look at it. I'm trying to contact these coaches. You have to navigate through the websites, you know, who do you talk to? And you ought to see the flow charts, the directories there. I mean, they're so Byzantine. It's just mind-boggling, you know, the bureaucracies that they create, you know, for a program like Alabama, Washington, USC, Clemson, you know, Texas, stuff like that. It's mind-boggling how vast, you know, an empire, you know, college football programs are at certain universities, the most elite universities. It's amazing. So that's why those tuitions are so high when you think about it, because you've got to pay for all those people. Seriously.
So maybe I don't want to ask you this on the air. Maybe I'll ask you here in a few minutes when we get done with the on-air portion of it. And I'll save that for that, because that'll be an interesting one, just between me and you, because sometimes there's good stuff that, you know, is good stuff. And then there's some stuff that's good stuff, but probably doesn't need to be a public record. We'll call it that.
Okay.
Sound like a plan?
Can I ask you a question, Jim? Remember, I think I gave you, you know, the file, the manuscript, right? I want to ask you this. When you saw the rankings where certain coaches ranked, which one surprised you the most?
Oh, you would ask. No, I was going to say, it's hard to compare eras because, you know, I'm a younger guy. So some of these names, like Bear Bryant, right, I know the stadium down in Alabama is named after him, right? But yeah. I don't necessarily know his record and, you know, all his statistics off the top of my head. So it was more of a learning experience trying to, like I said, because, you know, I was a Penn State fan, right? So my legend was present. No, you know, because every time you turn around, you know, you'd stand there beside someone and you'd be like, oh, yeah, I remember 77 when, you know, he did that same fake punt. You remember the fake punt from, you know, so you're standing, you know, you're listening to these stories.
Yeah.
But some of these universities, you know, they turn over coaches like, well, you know, I'm turning over paper here. You know, like the names just kind of leach through. And that was, I guess that's the hard part for me. Just, you know, and then you see those names, you go, oh, yeah, I do remember hearing that name, but I didn't realize this, that, and the other. So I didn't really answer your question. But
yeah. I there's a rhetorical point. I think the problem, it's not a knock on you, Jim, but I think overall, I think sports journalism has to have a better grasp of sports history. I mean, I get this impression sometimes if there's no videotape on it, therefore the subject really can't be important. Because like the other night, the ESPN's been doing, to commemorate the 150th anniversary of college football, they've been doing this series, you know, ESPN 30 for 30s, where they talk about various aspects of college football history. And they were talking about great what-if scenarios. And actually, it was a great concept, but that actually was very poorly judged. And they had a panel of people there, and I could tell that some of them really had no grasp of the overall history. They really had no concept like who Hurry Up Yost was or Glenn Pop Warner or people like that and what they really contributed to the game, or even Walter Camp for that matter, about, you know, the early years where there was no such thing there, like from 1869 to 1906, forward passing was not allowed. It was forbidden. It was strictly a running game. And to get a first down, you needed 3 tries to get only 5 yards to get a first down, okay? It's only after 1906 that, you know, forward passing was legalized, and you also had to get 10 yards and 4 downs and all of that. And even then, forward passing, there was like before 1939, if you threw an incomplete pass in the end zone, it was ruled a touchback, okay? Think about that for a moment.
I think they should bring that back, by the way. That'd be much better.
I mean, seriously, if you tried to throw a touchdown pass and it went incomplete, it was an automatic touchback and went to the other team. Can you imagine that?
Phenomenal. We need that back.
Yeah, and also, when you threw a forward pass, the guy throwing the ball had to be at least 5 yards behind the line of scrimmage for it to be legal. If he was not within 5 yards, it was an illegal pass. Think about that for a moment. The quarterback had to be 5 yards behind the line of scrimmage before he could throw a ball. And even back in the old days, the balls were very plump. It was more conducive for running and kicking. That's why you always heard about drop kicking and all of that, because it was more plump. It's only when the game of football became more streamlined that it became easier to throw a pass and all that, and drop kicking was phased out because the slimmer ball, it was more difficult to drop kick it. That's why you don't see drop kicking today and all of that. The emphasis was on place kicking and all that. And you would see these weird concepts like hurry up Yost created the punt and the pass and the prayer notion of defense. In other words, you always use your kicking team for field position. If you got the ball inside your own 20-yard line, you'd automatically punt it on first down. I mean, think about that. You just punt it on first down, and you want to make sure you pin the team, the opposing team deep in their territory, force the turnover, get the quick score that way. I mean, that's how football was, and that's how influential Yost was, because generations of coaches, all the way up to Darrell Royal, used that concept, I'd rather let the opposing team have the ball, use my defense to force the turnover, and then get the quick score and all of that. I mean, that was standard defensive strategy. Actually, last Super Bowl that was played was a very close approximation of what college football was like 100 years ago. You saw all that battle of the defenses between the Rams and the Patriots and all the punts there. That's the way college and pro football was played a century ago. Seriously, Jim, really.
Well, obviously, you ask your question, and we briefly referenced John Heisman, right?
Yes.
Besides the trophy, I mean, if it wasn't for the fact that he, like I said, grew up, 25 miles north of here, so there's a historic marker and all this other stuff about him.
Yeah,
that's the reason I know him, because he's kind of semi-local, right?
Yeah,
we're talking about a guy who from the turn of the last century.
Yes.
Limited video.
Yeah. Yeah. So. I mean, John Heisman bounced around a bit in the early late 1890s. He was like, I think it was like Auburn and a couple other places, Auburn and all that. And then he settled at Georgia Tech. His greatest work was at Georgia Tech. He put Georgia Tech on the college football map. He created powerhouses there. And especially in the mid-1910s, he had three straight seasons where I think it was like a 32 or 33 game winning streak or something like that. And they did not lose a game. They won like two or three national championships, not by the modern definition. There wasn't a AP poll back then, but in the eyes of various retroactive organizations like the Helms Foundation, the Holgate System, the National Championship Foundation, or the Billingsley Report, they were recognized as, if there had been a poll back then, they were the best team in college football. And he got this great work out of these Georgia Tech teams using a thing called the jump shift, which today would be illegal because, the rule is when you shift, you have to come to a full, complete one-second stop before the ball is snapped. Well, with his jump shift, they would line up in this weird, freaky thing. You only have one guy, and they would all line up behind him, and at the last second, they would shift into place. Just before the ball was snapped, they would split in this thing, and the ball would be snapped, and they would catch the defense off balance, and they would get great yardage out of that. And it was because of that they created the rule, after you shift, you must come to a full and complete one-second stop. That's the reason why you have that rule today, is because of that. And in fact, Rocky did the same thing with his Notre Dame box shift, that last-second shift maneuver to catch the defenses off balance. That was common back then, this type of shift. And the University of Minnesota under Henry L. Williams had the same thing, a very unique, an abrupt shift that would try to outflank defenses and all that. And Heisman had that, and it worked wonders. And in fact, what was it, 1970, 1918, they took on Pitt University, who too had a perfect unbeaten streak. And it was a battle of two great dynasties taking each other on. And the Pitt annihilated Georgia Tech 32-0, and that was literally the last gasp for Heisman. A couple years later, he left Georgia Tech, and then he kind of bounced around. He coached at Penn, he coached at Rice, and maybe some other place. And then he left coaching completely and went into the, you know, that New York Athletic Club, and that's where the Heisman Trophy was established.
So, Matthew, we got 25 seconds left. So, first, seriously, thank you for reaching out, because never know, and I'm glad you did.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you, and God bless you, and Merry Christmas, Jim.
Merry Christmas. Hang out with me for about another, I have one more off the record question. Everybody, thanks for tuning in. It's been a great, I've enjoyed myself. I know there's probably some people out there who are, tune in next week. It'll be different. That's all I can say if you didn't like the sports.
In a world infatuated with comic fandom, comes a show to help us remember the talents that have inspired us.
Whoa, 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 cut.
Oh, come on. It wasn't that bad.
It's a bit dramatic. Let's just tell them about the show, guys.
We are the Canned Air Podcast.
Join us weekly for a comedic trip through pop culture.
We also welcome some cool comic creators, as well as some of the voice and screen actors that helped shape your childhood.
Find us on CannedAirPodcast.com and on the Evergreen Podcast Network.